From NPR, this is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam.
If you would you walk us through a typical day for you?
Today, we're talking about finding meaning in our work.
I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door. That way, Lumberg can't see me. And after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah, I just stare at my desk. But it looks like I'm working.
This clip from the movie Office Space describes what work feels like to many people. Not the stuff of poetry. But now, imagine something that feels more than just a job.
My dream job is one where I feel like my individual work is making a difference.
My dream job is teaching sex education to children.
Oh, I wanted to be a TV weatherman.
To me, I guess it would be something dealing with like sports.
To run comms for somebody in office.
My dream job is to establish an organization for everybody to feel welcome.
Of course, not all of us are going to land our dream jobs. So how do we make the jobs we have more meaningful? Amy Rusnuski is a professor of management at Yale University. She studies work and something she calls job crafting.
What we learned is people who see their work as a calling are significantly more satisfied with their jobs. They're significantly more satisfied with their lives. They're more engaged in what it is that they're doing and tend to be better performers regardless of what the work is.
Amy says job crafting can help you make the job you have right now more satisfying. Amy Rusnuski, welcome to Hidden Brain.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was reading one of your papers recently, and I was struck by an excerpt that you had at the top. One came from a corporate securities lawyer, and one came from a taxidermist. And I was struck by what the two of them said. Can you tell me what they said?
Sure. So the corporate securities lawyer was bemoaning the fact that his job, as he saw it, was, I think his words were, a deal with the devil, that he did the job not because he liked it, but because it allowed him to stay geographically in an area that worked for his family and so on. And in contrast, the taxidermist was talking about the way in which the kind of work he did sometimes moved people to tears when they came and picked up the pieces that he had created for them, and how for him the feeling of satisfaction that comes from work that has that kind of impact is one of the biggest things in his life.
I have the paper in front of me. The taxidermist said, "I did a duck for a guy the other day, and when he came and picked it up, he almost started crying because it looked so nice. He was just so happy, and that made me feel good that he thought I'd done a good job. Self-satisfaction is a big deal in any job. It's a big deal in life." And I was so moved by that comment because, of course, if you just looked at those two jobs side by side, you might assume that the corporate securities lawyer with the high-profile fancy job is the person who's actually happier at work. But that's not often the case.
That's not often the case. And in fact, a good amount of the research that I've done has tried to look at how the experiences that people have in their work, the ways in which they talk about it and come to think about its place in their lives, vary so much across the entire spectrum in ways that research hasn't necessarily recognized.
When you went into a hospital some years ago and you looked at the people working as the cleaning staff of the hospital, you discovered something very interesting. You found that they did not all think of their jobs the same way.
That's true. And our first clue about this was not necessarily in how they talked about the ways that they thought about the job, but in how it was that they described the tasks of their job. So on the one hand, we had this group of hospital cleaning staff members who described the work as being not very high skill, and another group who described it in very different terms and said this was highly skilled work where it would be very difficult to bring others in and have them take over the job. And in looking to see what were the differences between these two groups of cleaners, we had no differences in the kind of shift that they worked, their tenure in the organization, the kind of units they worked on, and so on. Instead, what was different was what they described as being the kinds of things that they did during the daily course of the work. So in the first group, the cleaners who described the work as being not particularly high skilled, they very much hewed to the job description. And the job description, while extensive, doesn't involve a lot of interaction, in fact, any interaction with patients, visitors, nurses, doctors, and so on.
Presumably they were just swabbing floors, dusting, mopping, doing cleaning crew type stuff.
Exactly. And in the second group, they also talked about all of these kinds of things, but in addition talked about the kinds of things that they did on a regular basis for and with nurses, doctors, patients, and patients' visitors. And we checked this multiple times, but this was not something that they were being asked to do. Often these kinds of things were going beyond the notice of those who supervised them in the hospital in which they worked. But for the cleaners who engaged in this, we ended up calling this job crafting. They were crafting the boundaries of their jobs in ways that we think made the work for them more meaningful, was something that they very much undertook on their own.
If I remember correctly, some of the people who found their work especially difficult were in fact doing work that might be argued to be against the rules.
Yes. So some of the things that the cleaning staff members in this part of our sample described doing involved figuring out when would it be safe, for example, to give a patient a drink of water if they requested one, or when was it safe to help a patient to move, or things like this, which moves into the realm of patient care and could very well get them into trouble. But the cleaning staff members we studied had developed systems of figuring out when was it safe to do these things, when was it okay to do these things, versus when would it be necessary to go and get a member of the medical staff.
You found one woman in particular who did something really interesting when it came to patients who were in a coma. Tell me what she did.
So this particular staff member worked in essentially a long-term rehabilitation floor where patients were unconscious or comatose and hopefully would be emerging from those states. One of the things that she described doing was taking down the framed art prints. Most patient rooms have some kind of print or another. And she would take those down on a regular basis and rearrange them and rehang them. And when we asked her if this was part of her job or part of the duties that she was given in her job description, she answered that it was not. Which was quite striking. And in asking more deeply about, well, why do this, talked about the hope that even though patients were not necessarily aware of their surroundings, maybe some shift in the environment in which they were recuperating could spark something in them and speed their trajectory of healing.
In some way, she was behaving like we would behave toward a family member. You're trying to anticipate the needs of the person even before they're expressed. You're not following the letter of the law. You're actually trying to do everything you possibly can to ensure an outcome for someone you care about.
Absolutely. And we saw a lot of evidence of this in our data. So cleaning staff members who talked about getting in the room, sort of aiming their face sort of skyward to look at the ceilings of the hospital rooms to see if there were things that were up there that we might not notice but would bother the patients if the patients had to look at them all day long, so that they could take care of any dirt or sort of issues up on the ceiling. And we also heard a lot from the cleaning staff members about looking at each patient, and in many cases patients' families, as though, well, this could be my father or my mother or my brother or sister, and how would I care for them?
So there's two ways to look at these people who are doing things that are outside of their job description. You could call it at one level, you know, a form of insubordination. They're basically not following the rules at all. And you could say these are troublemakers and we want to make sure that we have as few of them as possible on the staff. But you can also see them as people who are going the extra mile and really internalizing the larger mission of the hospital and not just the descriptions of their jobs. What did you find in terms of the outcomes of having workers who are the one kind or the other?
Well, in this particular context, we were only gathering data about what it was that the hospital cleaning staff members said they were doing, and then what was that related to with respect to their experience on the job. We can only speculate as to what the outcomes were likely to be, but I would expect, for example, that particularly in a medical context, that it's hard to imagine that this wouldn't have had some kind of positive effect, because a lot of the things that the hospital cleaning staff members were talking about had to do with, you know, in the course of their cleaning work, noticing who hadn't had a visitor in several shifts, who looked like they might be on the verge of tears, who seemed like they really needed to talk so that they could finish with their work and double back to spend time with those patients or with those patients' family members. And it's hard to imagine that that kind of work doesn't have a positive impact in a context like that.
I want to talk about what these different kinds of initiative mean for the workers, but I want to just spend 1 second again looking at it from the point of view of the patient, which is that I think all of us in some ways have been in the shoes of those patients. May not be, you know, patients in a coma at the hospital, but we've been students in a class or, you know, going to the DMV to get a driver's license. And all of us have routinely encountered people who are there just doing their jobs and there because they really find some deeper meaning in their jobs. I remember a chemistry teacher that I had in high school. I wasn't particularly fond of chemistry, but the teacher was so inspired by the fact that chemistry was just the coolest subject in the universe that he communicated some of that excitement and enthusiasm to me. And I knew that he wasn't just doing a job teaching me chemistry. This was something he desperately and deeply wanted to do. And I feel like all of us have these experiences, and when we come in contact with these people, we feel like we are now in touch with the higher purpose of what this organization is supposed to be about.
I think that's very well put, very well said, and I completely agree. And in fact, the line of research I was involved in that led to this study originally started with exactly this question: how do people who are doing exactly the same job in the same organization come to see that work in such radically different terms, where some of them see it, as you put it, as just a job versus seeing the work perhaps more as a career? And then finally, people for whom that exact same work is something more akin to a calling. And these differences have always fascinated me, where they come from, what the implications are for the individuals who do the work and for the organizations that they're a part of.
We're talking with Yale management professor Amy Riznuski. In the second half of our conversation, we talk about what you can do to feel more engaged at work.
I think keeping my passions alive while I'm doing my work is what's most important. It's kind of how I
saw what I wanted to do within the agency, and it wasn't being done, and I raised my hand and said, I think I can do something about it.
There was a lot of mental reframing.
Seeing the big picture.
I enjoy what I do beyond like the tangible benefits of the work. It's something that I think contributes to my satisfaction as a person.
You're listening to Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting justice, equity, and opportunity for all people to foster and sustain safe and healthy communities. Learn more at langloth.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Some people think of their jobs as a stepping stone in their careers.
It's definitely part of my career. I think it's been a huge part of figuring out what I want to do and developing skills. So
others consider the work they do as something more.
It's something that I put time into achieving. And you know, I'm happy with the work that I put in, and I definitely consider it a calling.
Today, I'm talking with Amy Riznuski, a professor of management at Yale University, about how we can find meaning in work. I asked Amy what she'd found about people who think of their work as a calling.
What we learned is people who see their work as a calling are significantly more satisfied with their jobs. They're significantly more satisfied with their lives. They work more hours. They miss fewer days of work. They're more engaged in what it is that they're doing.
So when we look at these two different kinds of people in the workplace, and I think what we often say is, this person just happened to find the organization that suits him or her, that it's just happenstance and luck that people find their calling. What I find really interesting and intriguing about your work is that you suggest that there might actually be a more deliberate process involved so that more of us can find our work to be a calling.
It's a wonderful contrast that you draw here, because I do think that there are two different schools of thought in play around callings. And one is that it's out there, you have to find it, it's a matter of moving into the right role or the right position in the right organization and so on, and then suddenly this will be unlocked and your work will be this sort of joyful end in and of itself, which is very different from a view that I've come to, which is that can certainly happen, where people can stumble into something and realize this is what I would do even if I hit the lottery, versus how is it that I can craft the boundaries of this job and the way that I think about its role sort of in the world in such a way that I can come to experience it perhaps as something that is meaningful in a way that potentially a calling could be.
Several years ago, Amy, there was this major Powerball lottery jackpot that a lot of people got excited about, and NPR's CEO at the time bought every one of the company lottery tickets. So lots of people spent the day speculating what it would be like to, you know, win $200 million. What I found most interesting was that we asked several people, would you quit your job if you won this money? And I found it very revealing what people's answers were. Some people said, of course I'd quit my job. Why in the world would I keep working if I had $200 million? And other people had exactly the opposite response. Why in the world would I quit my job when I'm doing something I really enjoy? I think it speaks to what you're saying here. The people who are working because the work is an end in itself, and the people who are working because the work is a means to an end.
I think that seeing that divide and seeing that for even in the same exact job, that the work can mean such different things to different people doing that work, often with the same level of education, same level of pay and so on, is fascinating to me. And I think, you know, given the choice, I think what we're seeing now is many people as they grow up and it's time to, you know, come to think about what they want to do in their work are yearning for something that will feel a bit more like a job that you wouldn't necessarily want to quit if you hit the lottery. But I think that that's, depending on your theory of how these things work, if you think it's a magical unicorn out there that you just have to find, I think that that can be quite anxiety provoking for people.
So if finding one of these great jobs is not one of these magical things that happens, or it is a magical thing that can happen, but it's also something that can be crafted, as you suggest, what's the way to do it?
Well, I mean, I think that part of what is involved is thinking about what kinds of things do people feel they very much enjoy and that they think are important in the world, whether those are tasks that have to get done because they help the world function in a way that is of real benefit to society or to other people, to see how and where might you start to do things to make that work your own in a way that could feel even more fulfilling.
You've also looked at efforts to try and change what it is the job itself is. So you get hired for a job, you're maybe a typist, or maybe you're a computer programmer, or you're maybe a manager, but then you can start working to expand the contours of what the job description actually is.
Yes. One of the things that's interesting that I want to point out is that it's not only about expanding what those boundaries are and taking on more and doing more. Job crafting can also involve restricting that boundary, if you will. So maybe delegating or even pulling back or dropping some of the tasks that may be defined as part of the job that over time people perhaps come to realize are not actually central to getting done or executing on the kinds of things that the organization feels that they ought to be responsible for.
Now, a lot of people feel like they don't have the latitude to make those changes, that I'm stuck, my manager won't allow me to modify what I'm doing. There are ways that I can see I can be more productive and more useful to the organization, but I feel constrained and hemmed in. Those are real concerns.
They absolutely are. And even in jobs where this kind of crafting is explicitly forbidden, you still see people engaging in it. And I think it usually works like this. You recognize what it is that the organization expects you to accomplish, and you see where do you have the degrees of freedom that you might take advantage of to do that in a way that maybe from a process point of view or from a how you order the tasks point of view or who you interact with to get that work done point of view, how you can essentially customize that in a way that makes the experience more enjoyable, more meaningful, and something that perhaps makes you feel more connected to those who you're either working with or who are the recipients or beneficiaries of your work.
I'm also fascinated by the fact that you point out that it's not just crafting your job description that can allow you to find work that's a calling, but it's also recrafting or redefining the relationships you have with other people in the workplace. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Most jobs involve some level of contact with or interdependence with other people, whether those are coworkers, whether those are clients or customers. It's often these relationships and these interdependencies with other people on the job that are the sources of the greatest joys and the greatest frustrations. And so it, in some sense, doesn't surprise me that part of what it is that people are crafting are exactly that element. So the relationships and the interactions that are either necessary to executing the work or just come part and parcel with the doing of the job.
You also talk in your research about the idea of cognitive crafting, that besides, you know, changing the description of the job and the nature of the relationships around the job, there's also the way you think about the job, which in many ways is perhaps the thing you have the greatest control over. You have some ability to change what it is you're doing in how you come to think about what you're doing.
Yes. So the third form of crafting, so you can craft the tasks that comprise the job, the relationships and interactions that are part of the job. But this third category that you name, cognitive crafting, consists of how it is that people think about what the work even is. And it turns out that there's a lot of freedom in this, if you will, to go back to the hospital cleaning staff study. One of the questions that we asked the hospital cleaning staff members we interviewed was to give us your job title here. And some of the people in that study gave us their official technical title. Other people would say things like, I'm an ambassador, or in the most extreme case of someone sort of deviating, if you will, from describing the work the way that the organization would, said, I'm a healer. One of the things that excites us about the job crafting work is that these different ways of engaging in cognitive crafting seems to be related to how it is that people actually then go about executing the job, right? If you have that uniform on and you're on your shift and you are thinking of yourself as a healer, that is your responsibility and your role there, it's very different from thinking about it in terms of working through a particular task set in a day. And again, sort of where those differences come from, why some people do this, why others don't, and the difference that it makes for them is something that's been endlessly fascinating for us.
Amy Riznesky is a professor of management at Yale University. Amy, thank you for joining me on Hidden Brain today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Amy's research suggests that employees can play a powerful role in shaping the meaning of their work. But there are also ways that organizations can help employees find such meaning. Coming up, we consider how money and awards shape the way we think about our jobs. You're listening to Hidden Brain from NPR. I'm Shankar Vedantam. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from HomeAdvisor, committed to helping homeowners find the right pros for their home projects. Homeowners can check cost guides, book appointments, and pay for more than 100 everyday projects with the HomeAdvisor mobile app. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org. And from the ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. You may have noticed that our modern world is saturated with awards.
Welcome to the 77th Annual
Welcome
Peabody Awards.
Welcome to the 2019 Golden Globe
Awards. The 1 millionth Academy
the
Award.
Miss Universe
the Daytime Emmy Award.
65th Annual Tony
Teacher
Award.
Teacher of the
Annual
Ig Nobel Prize.
AFI Life Achievement Award.
Live from Copenhagen.
Many of these awards have been created in the past century. But awards have been around for millennia. The Greeks and Romans had them. Kings and queens have long given them to their bravest warriors. Societies all over the world have recognized their best citizens with prizes.
We pay tribute to those distinguished individuals with our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Awards are so ubiquitous that we rarely stop to ask, do they work? Do prizes inspire and motivate, or do they cause jealousy and resentment? Bruno Frey is an economist who has spent years studying how prizes shape human behavior. He works at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Along with Jana Gallus, he is co-author of the book Honors versus Money: The Economics of Awards. Getting an award makes people feel good, but Bruno says the real benefits of awards are seen long after that initial glow wears off.
When people are given an award in general, they are likely to work better, to be more engaged, to have, as we say, higher intrinsic motivation. That is, they like to work and they like to do what they do and therefore are contributing really to the social good.
An important reason awards have this effect is that they are deeply social. Awards are handed out in settings where you are surrounded by your peers. An award can make you feel appreciated by people whose opinions you value. In this regard, an award is very different than a cash bonus.
Normally, people are not allowed to say how large the bonus is they receive. So it is unknown to other people. While awards are always given in a ceremony, sometimes in a lavish one, sometimes in a smaller one, but it's always with other people around. And the person or the organization giving the award specifies exactly why the person or the organization gets the award. And this emphasizes the extraordinary engagement of the people receiving the awards. And that tends to raise the intrinsic motivation because it's recognized, because it's appreciated.
One of the things that you and others have learned is that people care intensely about the prestige that awards can confer, perhaps even more than money. Prizes provide glory. I want to play you a clip from the world of golf. This is the 2017 PGA Championship winner, Justin Thomas.
In terms of this week, it's definitely not about the money. It's definitely not about being better than anybody else. Like I said earlier, I just like to win, and I like trophies, so I just want to win, to go win not only the Tour Championship, but anytime you can win a year-long race and be known as a champion of an entire year, it's a big deal. So that to me is what I would be most excited about.
Bruno, do you see other examples of people who actually prefer prestige and glory to money?
Yes, there are very many instances of that. Just consider if you want to invite a famous person, let's say, coming from the U.S. to Europe or from Europe to the U.S., if that person has a high income already, a good income, then it's very difficult to get people. There is a nice example, namely Roger Federer, one of the famous Swiss. He earns about 93 million, and I don't think that you can induce him to go anywhere to get anything. But when you offer him a nice award, you have a better chance to do that.
I'm wondering about another area that you discuss in the book, which is it's not just a benefit to individuals who win awards, but there are benefits to organizations as well, especially if you're an organization that doesn't necessarily have a lot of money or you don't have the leeway to pay people a lot of money. Awards are really a powerful way to increase motivation.
Yes, indeed. And it also creates a bond of loyalty between the giver and the recipient. You cannot accept the order by the Queen of England and then say, she's a silly woman, or I don't care about awards. Because then people say, why did you accept it? But people do accept awards. Of course, there are cases in which awards are not accepted, but in general, people accept the awards, and then there is a new bond of loyalty, a special relationship to the one who gives the award. And that is also important in for-profit capitalist enterprises.
I'm wondering if this might be one of the reasons why you have so many awards in military service, especially because it's not just that you're conferring, you know, recognition on people who've done important things, but building those bonds of relationships, the connections between, you know, superiors and subordinates, that is actually essential for a successful military.
Indeed. And especially in the military sector, it's difficult to define what a good soldier, a good officer, a good general must do, because you cannot fix that in advance. So you must rely on the persons to do the right thing.
Right. And how do you put a price on bravery or loyalty or integrity?
Yes, that's not possible, because is bravery $10 million or $5,000 or whatever? Right. One doesn't know. While if you give an order and then in the ceremony you say, oh yes, this soldier did something beyond his duty, something extraordinary, that is totally sufficient to make the recipient very happy.
You conducted a field experiment on awards with the site Wikipedia. This was the German language Wikipedia. And in Wikipedia, of course, it's the online encyclopedia where each article is crowdsourced by editors and readers. Tell me about the field experiment and what you found.
We introduced a new award. We invented one, actually. And we gave this award to people who continued contributing work to Wikipedia, because we observed, or that is a problem of Wikipedia, that a lot of people contribute one article and then stop. So we introduced an award which is called Edelweiss.
The Edelweiss was a badge that was placed on the profile pages of some Wikipedia editors. The names of winners were also included on a Wikipedia page that described the award. Bruno and his colleague Jana Gallus observed how receiving an Edelweiss affected the retention rates for these editors compared to those who had not received one.
Previously, 35% only continued working for Wikipedia and contributed another article or helped work with an article, and this rose from 35 to 42%. So a much larger proportion of people engaged in Wikipedia were induced to go on with the work.
Mm. Now, of course, someone can say 35 to 42% is not a sea change, but of course the intervention is relatively inexpensive and cheap. You're basically giving someone a recognition, a title. Wikipedia is not giving them money. It's actually relatively easy to do.
Absolutely. That's a very important point. This Edelweiss award is absolutely doesn't cost anything. You just put it on the web, but people really appreciate that. And so this increase in retentions for the work especially of newcomers is quite substantial. And to me, it was surprising that it was so large.
Most awards are meant to be taken seriously. But there's a growing genre of awards that are meant to be ironic. There's the Ig Nobel Prize, which recognizes innovations in science that make you laugh. And there's the Razzie, which is given to the worst Hollywood films each year. In 2002, Halle Berry won an Oscar for her performance in the movie Monsters Ball. 3 years later, she starred in Catwoman. For that role, she received not an Oscar, but a Razzie.
I've got so many people to thank, because you don't win a Razzie without a lot of help from a lot of people. So, first of all, I want to thank Warner Brothers. Thank you for putting me in a piece of god-awful movie.
So, Bruno, what do ironic awards like the Razzie or the Ig Nobel Prize, what do they do? How do they affect human behavior?
When something is very important, such as a Nobel Prize or Academy Awards, Oscars, it's always attractive to do exactly the opposite. And this Golden Raspberry Award is exactly the opposite of the normal Oscar. To be the worst actor or the worst actress is also giving attention. And if one accepts this negative award in such a fantastic way as the actress we just heard, it's very good for her, because then people say she's an open person, and that throws a positive light on her.
Of course, in this case, you know, thanking Warner Brothers is sort of a backhanded way of saying Warner Brothers made a terrible movie.
Exactly, yes. She did it in a very charming way, and that's wonderful.
The Razzies, of course, are meant to be tongue-in-cheek. But sometimes, awards that are meant to be an honor can have unintended consequences. One of the running jokes on the sitcom The Office was the Dundee Awards. The Dundies were an annual prize given to employees at Dunder Mifflin, the paper company where the show was set.
The Dundies are about the best in every one of us.
Fans of the show will remember that the Dundies were a train wreck, one in which the head of the office, Michael Scott, humiliated himself along with everyone else.
The Dundies! How can I explain it?
You don't have to be an employee of Dunder Mifflin to know that awards can backfire. Sometimes they backfire in interesting ways. For example, the researchers Carly Robinson and Yana Gallas recently tracked 15,000 middle and high school students in a California school district. The school system was giving out awards to students who had perfect attendance. Carly says, to everyone's surprise, the kids who got these awards began attending school less often.
When students receive these retrospective awards, it signals to them that they were attending school more than their classmates. And this award also potentially signals that the school had low expectations for their attendance. So they were actually overshooting their school's expectations for their own attendance.
So, Bruno, what does this story tell us about how recipients don't always take away from an award what givers intend?
One should not get an award for something which is the normal part of one's activities, because then they lose their meaning. An award should really indicate or signal that one does something extraordinary, which is not described or imposed from outside, that really comes from a special engagement. If one hands out an award for just everything, they lose their special character.
So in some ways, what you're saying is when awards are scarce, people actually look at them and they have value, but you can actually devalue an award by giving out too many of them.
Absolutely, yes. It's with everything. If one does it too much, it doesn't have any effect anymore.
Let's look at another study. Kirk Doran and George Borjas found that winners of the Fields Medal, this was a prize for mathematicians under the age of 40, respond in some ways like the students in California. Compared to mathematicians who nearly win but don't, the winners end up dabbling in new areas of mathematics where they end up being less successful. Here's Doran.
I think it's not what John Charles Fields expected. He expected that in giving people a prize to honor and extol their previous work, that would encourage them to do more of the same work. What we find is that, you know, the opposite takes place.
What do you make of this, Bruno? In some ways, this paper was arguing that the mathematicians who nearly win, they're tipped to be winners of the Fields Medal, but since the medal is given only to people under the age of 40, there are people who pass the age of 40 without winning it. But ironically, it finds that those people end up being more productive, at least as measured by the number of papers they write. So in some ways, the award is actually not producing what the originator of the award intended.
It didn't produce with the recipients of the Fields Medal, but with the others. So in a way, the purpose was reached. And I think the others who didn't get the prize want to get recognition in some other way and therefore work hard while the recipients are satisfied, because a mathematician cannot get more than the Fields Prize.
That's a fascinating idea. In some ways, I think what you might be hinting at is that potentially the benefits of some awards might be seen more in the people who don't win the award, because it motivates them to try harder. Even if they'd never win an award, it still helps the whole field because they're doing all this extra work.
Right, right. But that's not always the case. Very often, or in many instances, when an award is given to some person or to some persons, and those not getting an award may be getting mad, or they think they are not appreciated. So there's also this negative side about it.
I remember reading a column by Paul Krugman. He was writing in the New York Times a few months ago, and he was talking about how people are often dissatisfied. He even in the field of economics, he said, you know, there are people, you know, who are working at various universities who are envious of their colleagues who are working at, you know, Harvard and Chicago, and the people who are working at Harvard and Chicago are envious of the people who've won the Nobel Prize and they haven't won it. So even when you're at the very top of your game, you can find sources of resentment when you see that other people around you are doing even better.
I heard the story that a Nobel Prize winner, when he gets the Nobel Prize or she gets the Nobel Prize, starts thinking about there are five people who got two Nobel Prizes. It's incredible.
Yes, of course. So there's no end to it.
No.
In 2016, former British Prime Minister David Cameron was criticized for seeking to give high state honors to a bunch of cronies. Among the list of recipients was Mrs. David Cameron's stylist, Isabel Spearman. Here's what Tom Watson of the Labour Party had to say about David Cameron's awards list.
I think people will be shocked at the scale and size of this list. You know, there's a reasonableness test that should be applied to these lists. And I think most reasonable people would say it's unacceptable to give Mrs. Cameron's stylist an OBE and to hand out knighthoods to members of parliament like confetti.
So it surely must be the case, Bruno, that award givers sometimes misuse their position to confer honor and legitimacy on their friends.
Absolutely. If that is done, that is a grave mistake. So it's a bad policy, for instance, for a king or a queen to give it to people who are very much on their side, because then the award or the order given loses importance. It would be a bad policy.
So there's a tension here, isn't it? Which is if you've just come into power, you know, and I think you give the example of Hitler actually doing this with the Iron Cross, which was also a medal that was given out very scarce initially. And then once Hitler came to power, he sort of distributed it like candy in some ways to large numbers of people, if I recall correctly.
Exactly.
But there must be a temptation to do this because you've come in and you want to solidify and strengthen your position. And the cheapest and easiest thing to do is to just simply spew these awards around.
Yes, that is the problem. Before we discussed that a positive side of awards is that they don't cost much money. But the negative side is that you can distribute heaps of them and it doesn't cost you anything, but it destroys the award.
If you can undermine an award by giving it out to undeserving people, Bruno says you can also undermine awards by doing exactly the opposite. If you give awards only to people who are already acknowledged superstars, this shuts the door to outsiders who may have truly revolutionary ideas. Bruno cites the example of an extraordinary researcher who didn't win the Nobel Prize. The reason? He was also known as a blunt provocateur.
Gordon Tullock was a very extraordinary economist. He was a professor of economics, but who was a lawyer. And that was the first thing, that he's a little bit of an outsider. He wrote with James Buchanan an important book in Public Choice. And then James Buchanan won the Nobel Prize, though much of the contribution of the book is due to Gordon Tullock. And it's even written in the introduction that he contributed the major idea of the book. And the reason he didn't get the prize was, I was told that by members of the Nobel Prize Committee, that they didn't know how he would behave when he gets the prize, because the Nobel Prize winners afterwards give a talk of gratitude. There was one example already that is Friedrich von Hayek. He got the Nobel Prize and then said the Nobel Prize is not a very good idea for economists. And of course, Nobel Prize Foundation didn't want to have a similar talk again. So it was unclear how Gordon Tullock would behave, while James Buchanan, he was a southerly gentleman, and everybody knew that he would behave in the appropriate way.
Hmm. You know, as we've been talking, I'm realizing how complicated this field is, because in some ways, you are trying to manipulate people by giving them an award. At some level, you are trying to shape human behavior. You're trying to recognize people who've done great work. You're trying to inspire other people. But you're also trying to do it in a way that doesn't feel controlling, which doesn't feel like you're actually manipulating people. So a good award inspires people and communicates sort of the norms of the organization without necessarily feeling heavy-handed, even though it actually may have been designed, in a fairly heavy-handed manner. There's a real paradox and tension there.
Yes, indeed, yeah. It's difficult to give good awards because one might also run the danger that one gives it to people who do not earn it or deserve it. And that's very bad for an award if it's given to people who didn't deserve it. And that's, of course, very bad for the giver of the award because it's no longer going to the right people.
Huh. You know, you've talked at various points, Bruno, about how money is not a very good reward. If you were to use money as an award, what is the best way to use it as an incentive that actually improves the well-being of the organization, the morale of the organization, rather than setting it back?
I think an award in terms of money would be important for people with low income. But for people who have already sufficient wealth and are in a good position, it's rather negative when the award is accompanied by money. Let's take again Roger Federer. I mean, if he gets an award and he gets $10,000 or even $100,000 going with it, I think that's almost ridiculous. And I would even argue that in the case of the Nobel Prize, it's unnecessary to hand out the money. I think the Nobel Prize is such an important thing for the recipients that everybody would take it even if no money was going with it.
Huh. So why is it that awards like the Nobel Prize give out money as well as give out the award?
Because looking from outside, especially at the beginning when the award is not yet generally known, the fact that it goes with money gives it importance.
In one of the early episodes of Hidden Brain, we interviewed someone who worked at a company. This person had an interesting idea. Rather than give out cash awards, the person essentially set up, this was the owner of the company, set up a little fund where any employee could give any other employee a cash award. And the benefit of doing this is the employee who was giving out the award not only could give out an award for good behavior or work well done or exceptional service, but also had to write up why they thought the recipient deserved the award. So in some ways, it solidified both the giver as well as the receiver's sense of why the award was being given. Do you think that's an effective way to use money as a motivational tool?
That's very interesting indeed. I think this goes very much in the direction of awards, namely that one expresses exactly why somebody gets this additional amount of money. One really has to think in a more social context. And I think this idea of handing out money in this way is interesting and certainly goes in the right direction. But I would argue that the same would be the case if employees could give other employees awards.
I ended my discussion with Bruno by talking about someone who dissed the world's most famous award. When the Nobel Committee awarded Bob Dylan the Nobel Prize in Literature, he responded with silence for several weeks. The comedian Tim Heidecker composed this very Dylan-esque song.
Well, I don't need your prize, babe, I don't need your prize. Just look into my eyes, babe, see how I despise the prize. See how I despise the prize.
So, Bruno, what happens when someone rejects an award?
I think even worse is not to react as Bob Dylan did. That is the worst thing. To at least reject it is a reaction. Something happens. While to just say, oh, whether I get the Nobel Prize or not is totally irrelevant. That is the worst thing.
Of course, Bob Dylan did eventually accept the prize. But Bruno says he thinks it's unlikely that rock singers will ever again get the Nobel Prize in Literature.
And, of course, the committee first talks to potential recipients and informally asks them whether they would accept the prize. And that is now the common procedure, that important prizes are not just given. One talks to people before whether they would accept it, and when they say no, it's not revealed that they were chosen as possible recipients.
Bruno Frey is a professor and economist who has spent years studying how prizes and awards shape human behavior. He works at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Along with Jana Gallus, he is co-author of the book Honors versus Money, The Economics of Awards. Bruno, thank you for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Shankar, I thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.
Today's episode was produced by Max Nestrak and Thomas Liu. It was edited by Tara Boyle and Jenny Schmidt. Our team includes Raina Cohen, Parth Shah, Laura Quirrell, and Kat Schuknecht. Anya Grundman is NPR's Senior Vice President for Programming. For more Hidden Brain, you can follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. Please be sure to subscribe to our podcast. I'm Shankar Vedantham. Thanks for listening to Hidden Brain. I'll see you next week.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, committed to supporting local businesses by connecting project-ready homeowners with local home improvement professionals for hundreds of projects. Learn more at homeadvisor.com. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, guided by the belief that the arts and humanities are essential to the well-being of diverse and democratic societies. Learn more at mellon.org.